So just very quickly, I'm Daryl Baker, and the company, our company is called Keldar Leadership. We do a lot of different things in leadership development, leadership training, some customer service work, some sales training work even, a lot of facilitation work on different things, and a big part of our business is working with assessment tools to help companies and organizations select the very best people and also use that information in understanding people for coaching, for succession planning, for advancement in the company, understanding how teams work more effectively. So there's a lot of information that comes out of the assessments. So some of you in the room may in fact have completed a Profile XT already, and if you didn't bring it with you, that's not a problem at all, but you may go back and take a look at it again after we go through this, because it might help shed a little light on some things here. So the presentation that I'm going through today, I'm just going to pop up a slide here that everybody should be able to see here. Everybody see session number one, Superior Performance Information Gap? Is that on your screen right now?
Yep.
Okay, super. So what I'm doing is I'm going through a modified presentation here that's designed to give you a little bit of background on what the Profile XT is designed to do, and then we're going to go through the scales that are part of the Profile XT to help you understand what it means based on people being to the left or being to the right or being to the middle of these different scales. And hopefully through that process, there'll be a really good understanding of the information that comes from this. So is there any questions before I get started? All right, I shall begin then. So the big thing here is that the Profile XT assessment, the whole purpose behind it is to provide you additional information about how people really are. In different situations, people can present different ways. They can make themselves look a particular way for a particular period of time. But what the Profile XT really does is it asks a whole bunch of questions in the assessment process that are really designed to get underneath the hood of a person to really tell us who they really are. So over time, if we're acting a little bit out of character to try to fit into a situation, that will get tiring over time. And so one of the things that we're trying to do with utilizing this assessment is really understand how a person really is, so we can make sure that we understand how they can fit best into an environment or how we can make little adjustments on coaching them or working with them to help them fit better where they're at. So this next slide is simply just making a statement that getting the right people on the team and getting in the right position is really the difference between an organization or a company flourishing and moving ahead, or it really can be a disaster. And it depends really a lot on where a person, the roles and responsibilities they have within an organization. The more significant the role as far as affecting other people, if a person's not a good fit in that position, then we can have a real ripple effect impacting a lot of people. So again, the more impact a person is having in the organization, if they're a great fit and they're doing really well in what they're doing, that's going to have a huge positive impact on an organization. And vice versa, if they're not such a good fit, then we'll have some other challenges. So there was a study that was done a number of years ago by some interpersonal psychologists that took a look back at many, many years of studies as to determine what was the breakdown within companies as far as superior performance, average producers, and non-producers. And what they came up with doesn't seem too amazing right at the outset, but they basically found out that in most organizations and companies that 16% of the people in the company were performing as superior producers, meaning that if we're that magical widget term, if we said that the expectation in a job is to do 10 widgets an hour, 16% of the people were doing more than that. They were producing at a superior level. 68% were average. They were doing exactly as was expected of them. And then we had 16% that were non-producers. They were people that were producing at a lower than expected rate, and it wasn't changing. And so the question was, so why does this really matter? Why do we care about this? And what they were able to do is they were actually able to figure out some percentages of impact with being a superior producer versus an average producer versus a non-producer. So on the slide that you have in front of you right now, it looks like a lot of information, but it actually breaks down pretty pretty easily. What they found is that in unskilled or semi-skilled positions within a company, an average worker's output was 19% more than a non-producer's. And a superior's output was 19% more than an average. So there was this gap of a superior performer was doing 38% more than a non-producer. And that was on an unskilled or semi-skilled position. Now, as I mentioned before, the more significant your role is as far as impacting other people and making a difference in the organization, the spread gets larger. So we see that a skilled worker, the average was 32% more than a non-producer, superior 32% more than average. So now we're talking about a 64% spread in the actual output between a superior and a non-producer. And then we move into the management levels, the professional levels, the people that are making the budget decisions and the strategic planning decisions and overseeing large numbers of people. The impact is even more significant, and it just makes sense because they're touching more people's, you know, lives, their businesses, their functions within the organization. So they're going to have this ripple effect. So the average worker's output, 48% more than non-producers, superior, 48% more than average. So we've got this 96% spread. So if you just think about maybe it's your past experiences working someplace, if you've got somebody that's top of an organization or a senior position or they're some technical expert that's impacting a lot of people, if they're really on their game and they're fantastic at what they do and they're hitting it out of the park, it has a huge positive impact in the organization. But if they're not in the right place and they're not doing a great job, it's got tremendous, tremendous potential downside. So if we take a look at a company, this is just sort of to take a little look at what if we put some numbers to this. And so don't worry so much about the numbers. This is a little bit of an older slide. It doesn't really matter what the numbers are. It gives you the impression. But if we looked at a smaller company that had 50 unskilled or semi-skilled workers, 25 skilled workers, and 10 managers, and we took a look at them getting some fairly average salaries, what would this mean when we put numbers to it? So, again, some of you, you'll grab this right away because you really like working with numbers. Some of you might want a little more time on this. And, again, we're recording this, so you're going to be able to come back and look at this again. But if we just looked at average salaries, and again, these are very low salaries, probably based on today's standards, but it doesn't matter. Again, it's just for demonstration purposes. $20,000 salary. If there's a 19%, this is what we're looking at is the cost of average versus superior. So remember, we're giving up 19% of productivity. So for every $20,000 salary, we're saying that we're missing out on $3,800 of productivity if we've got average people versus superior performers. You multiply that by 50 people, that's $190,000 a year. On the skilled end of things, $40,000 salary, if there's a 32% loss of productivity because we've got a bunch of average people versus superior, that's $12,800 per position times 25 people is $320,000 in a year. And in a management position of $60,000, again, if we're giving up 48% on the productivity, it's costing us $28,000 per position times 10 is $280,000. So for that relatively small company, that's $750,000 a year that you're giving up, which is 30% of the salary, that's just not being utilized at a superior level. We're not getting the maximum out of this opportunity. And a lot of people think, well, that's just the way it is. You know, that's just the way things are set up. You got, 20% of the people that are going to be, it's like you look at it as baseball scenario. You got 20% of the people that are hitting it out of the park, and you got 60% of the people that are in the park, and there's 20% of the people that are driving around. They can't even find the ballpark. And a lot of people think that that's just the way life is in a business, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I'm going to show you what we can do here about this. So the implication is the figures in that previous page are not worst case scenario because we were looking at the difference between average and superior. So if we look at actually having a number of people on our teams that are non-producers, they're not meeting the expectations, they're causing us grief, we're spending a lot more time just fixing their mistakes, our implications could be as much as double. So we were just looking at a scenario if we're dealing with average versus superior. But if we've got a lot of non-producers, that could be a real challenge. So The objective is every time we make a hiring decision, every time we move somebody up in the organization, we make a decision on where people need to be, we need to be thinking about how can we move people from an average position to a superior position. How can we get them in a place, get the right people in the right places so that they can perform at a superior level? So that's the challenge. Every decision, hiring, placement, promotion, we want to get people at superior performance in the positions they're moving into. So the question is what is this superior performance stuff that we're talking about? When do people perform at a superior level? Well, Harvard Business Review did a study on this, and they found out that it really wasn't to do with college degrees or technical tickets and this type of thing, and it wasn't about your experience. It really hinges on the fit with the job. Now, having said that, we obviously for roles within any company, if you require a certain ticket or a certain diploma or a certain degree or a certain level of education to do the job, well, absolutely, we understand you have to have that minimum. And if you have to have 2 or 3 years of experience, great, you have to have that minimum. But that is not going to necessarily determine whether you're great at your job. It just says that you've got what it takes to do the job. So the superior performance is going to hinge on a person really fitting with the job. And they found that if people didn't fit with the job when we hired them and put them in a place, it's not that they figured it out later. A lot of times it just continued to get worse. So here's a slide that's just talking about 6 months after hire. If somebody was matched, they're going to outperform somebody who doesn't match their position at a considerable level. And it's not that after a period of time people catch up. They just continue to outpace them, and the spread gets larger. And you can think about people that you've worked with over the years, and you know what we're talking about here is that it's not that somebody, comes onto the job and they aren't a good fit for the job, and, 2 years later, all of a sudden, something changes magically, and they're a great fit for the job. I mean, maybe that happens once in a while, but not very often. Generally speaking, somebody comes in, they're a really good fit for the job, and they just take to it, and off they go. And somebody who's not a good fit, well, it just the gap widens over time. So we really get two shots at superior performance. We can place the right people the first time. We can do a good job of our selection and get the right people in the right spots. Or the other option is we get to coach the people we've got. And coaching is important. And being a good manager, being a good leader of your teams, very important. But if you're spending all your time coaching people that really aren't in the right jobs or they're not a good fit, that's a lot of work. And it's a lot of effort that doesn't necessarily ever get you those superior results. So the question is have you ever hired or promoted someone who did not live up to your expectations? And I'm not in front of you, so I can't see you put your hands up, but I've done this in person, and I put my hand up at this point in time. Have I ever hired or promoted someone who didn't live up to my expectations? Absolutely, I've done that. And then the next slide, somebody says, have you ever hired or promoted someone who greatly exceeded your expectations? And I'll bet you around the table you're nodding your heads right now, because I know myself. I've hired some people where I thought, well, I think this person will work out. They seem like they're all right. They're average or whatever. And then they absolutely amaze me about how great they are once they get into the role. So the question is how different was the process used in the two cases? If you do the same process in selecting somebody, and sometimes you get somebody who doesn't meet your expectations, and another time they exceed your expectations, The question is, can we do anything different to get a little better result? Sometimes we hire somebody, and this is what happens. It's like, if I'd only known that Joe was this kind of person, and that's the challenge, is in doing a good job of predicting how a person will do down the road. It's difficult if we just use traditional processes in the selection. So this is the traditional process where we take a look at a person's, education, training, experience, skills, this type of thing. So it's what's on their resume and their application and this type of thing. And then we take a look at the company fit. We look at their attitude, values, all this type of thing. And this is what happens in the interview process. But we've got this whole chunk about how this person is really going to be down the road. And that's what we have to figure out. Because when a person goes to an interview, they're applying for a job, they put on their very best, right? They want to look the very best. So you see this shiny, like the top of the iceberg, you see the very best. And this is them making sure that we're seeing them at their best, and I don't think a lot of people put poor references on their application. They usually put their very best references. So everybody wants to look their very best when they're trying to get a job. And once they get in, this is what you get. You get the rest of the picture. And sometimes it exceeds what you're looking for, and sometimes it doesn't work out. And when it doesn't work out the way you hoped it would, well, you can start to see the ship sinking all over the place. And so sometimes I'm sure some of you have hired somebody, and it's like on the 90th day after probation, the evil twin shows up, and it's like, where did this come from? This person was just kind of doing just what they needed to basically get in the door and stay in the door. And if we had a little more information, we might have made a different decision. And that's where we find this third part, is if we can do a job match, if we can understand a person's personality, their abilities, their interests, if we can get this figured out before we commit too much time and energy into getting them in the door and getting them into a particular job, we can know a little bit more whether or not they're really going to be a good fit there, or whether we're trying to, you know, cram a square peg into a round hole here. So if we just use a traditional interview that really just asks the person about their experience and what would they do in certain situations, and it's just pretty basic interview about their background and experience, we might get it right 1 in 7 times, because it's information that people can almost make up. Like if somebody asks me, well, how would I do something in a warehouse? Well, I can figure out what you'd want me to say, and I can say that, right? Which is quite a bit different than somebody asking me, well, tell us about how you've operated in a warehouse under whatever situation you might want to put them in, and tell us about how you've provided a safe work environment utilizing forklifts in a warehouse. Well, if a person's never done that, or they can't give you a good answer, that's going to give you more information. But if you just use the basic, tell us how you would, then people can kind of make things up. So, you know, you don't want to be in a situation where you're just kind of flipping a coin on people, whether or not they get the job or they don't get the job. You want to make sure that you've got really good information when you're making a selection. So this is how it builds up. If you just do a basic interview, you're going to get 14% of the information you're looking for. If you do background check, you're going to improve that to about 26%. So then the question is how can we make this better? And this comes back to this piece about that the Harvard Business Review did this study where they said it really hinges on the fit with the job. So what they found out is superior producers fit their jobs, so they do have that education required for the position, the experience required for the position, and they can deal with the mental demands of the position, so the information's coming at them at a speed that neither bores them or overwhelms them. They're comfortable with the demands of the environment and the people they must work with, so the types of interactions they have with people, the types of situations they get put in, they're comfortable. They're not too stressed out, and they're feeling like this is a comfortable place for them to work. And the third, of course, is they enjoy the work, and they're motivated to do it. So they like what they're doing, and they're fired up to do that every day. It's not a chore for them to get out of bed, come to work, because they really like what they're doing. So the question is what happens if you don't put the right people in the right jobs? Well, pretty much the list is not real long on what happens there. They quit because they're not happy, they don't like what they're doing, so they quit. Or you fire them because they're not doing what you expected them. And so there's the fire them, they quit and leave, and then there's the third part. They can quit and stay. That's even worse. So you know those people, right? They've quit and they stayed. So they've decided what they will do. They do just enough to kind of hang around, and they're not happy in what they're doing, and you're not happy because they're not doing what they should be doing. So the question is can we do a better job of trying to get these people in the right spots? So this graph is just it's a poll that Gallup did a number of years ago on the impact of poor job fit, and it's just from around the globe. And I just throw it in here just to say it's not a Canadian thing. There's countries all over the world that are challenged with, they've got some high producers that are very engaged and doing great stuff. They've got a lot of average producers. It says not engaged employees, but it just means that they're doing their job. It's a job, but you're not fired up about it. And then there's this percentage of people that are actively disengaged. They're actually creating havoc. And see poor old France, they're at 31%, but if you know anything about the labor issues in France, there's a rally going on, or there's a strike going on, or there's something going on every week in France. They have a lot of labor unrest there, and so there's a lot of people who are unhappy. So this is something that's an impact around the globe, and so the question is what can you do about it at West Fraser? What can you do about it at Slave Lake Pulp? What can be done specifically to kind of get past this? So here's what we look at doing is we still do the interviews and background checks, of course, but adding into that personality and behavior, if we can understand that about a person, that's going to give us more information. If we can understand their mental abilities as far as how they process information, and this is not IQ, it's just the style that people like to learn and like to take on things. If we understand that about people, that's going to help. If we understand what they're actually fired up and excited about and interested in, that's going to help. And we can actually really improve things if we can then take all this information that we learn about somebody and then match them to a specific position based on what we know gives us superior performance in that position. It's not going to be foolproof. We're still going to hire somebody or promote somebody that's not a perfect fit. But what it's going to do is it's going to give us a lot better chance that we get it right. And that's going to save an awful lot of coaching work. It's going to save a lot of grief as far as getting people in the wrong position and then trying to figure out what can we do with this person now? Can we move them someplace else? And it's just it just makes for a better workplace and happier, more productive people in what they're doing. So, any questions up to this point in time? Okay, hearing none, let me move on and tell you a little bit more about what the actual Profile XT will do as it relates to this background information. So we're just really saying here in these next few slides, we're giving you information now about what these different scales really mean and how this information can be helpful. So the Profile XT takes a look at thinking style, behavioral traits, and occupational interests. So it absolutely mirrors the information that Harvard Business Review study found out, where they found out that really it's about job fit, and job fit about mental capabilities, about fitting the environment, and liking what you do. So that's exactly what the Profile XT has been designed to do, is to try to understand that information about people through asking them a series of questions. So it's all broken into these different categories, and we're going to go through each one. Now, you'll notice that these scales, there's 10 blocks in these scales as they run across. And these are called, this is a Sten graph, so it's got 10 blocks. And I'll explain what this means as you move from left to right or right to left on these blocks in just a second here. So all of you have a copy of the quick reference guide. And what the quick reference guide, it doesn't look exactly like this, but what it does do is it gives you a bit of information based on if somebody's scoring to the left on a scale or they're scoring to the right in the scale and what the scale is trying to determine or trying to understand. So this is a great time to pull those quick reference guides out and kind of follow along as I go through the different scales, and then that way you can make notes if you want to, or it might just kind of make more sense, I guess, as we go through. So the first thing that I want to emphasize here is that this Sten graph, it follows what we call a normal population distribution curve. So what that's telling us is that on each of these scales, 16% of the population is going to score 8 to 10, 16% is going to score 1 to 3, and 68% of the people that complete this assessment are going to score 4 to 7. And this is based on the North American population. So it's been pretty standardized that way. So what we have to recognize, really, really important piece here, is that 10's not good and 1's bad, and 1's not good and 10's bad, and 5 and 6 aren't good or bad. It is what it is. When a person completes the assessment and they get placed on one of these scales in a particular area, that's just what they are. And it doesn't really matter too much, other than what we hope is and what the objective is that we like where they fit on this scale to fit what we require in the position that they're in. And we need different things for different positions. So if we just thought about this for a second and we said, this scale that we're looking at right now is really looking at height. And if we look at somebody that is far to the right, so they're an 8, 9, 10, we're going to say that person's really tall. They're like 7 feet tall. And if we look at the 1, 2, 3, we say somebody to the left or they're scoring in that 1, 2, 3, they're quite short. They're maybe under 5 feet tall. So if I'm in the process of selecting people to play basketball, I want to get people that are scoring 8, 9, 10 on the height scale because that's going to make a lot of sense. If I'm looking at people to put a gymnastics team together, I'm probably more likely looking at the 1, 2, 3. If I'm looking to select people that in their course of their job, they have to reach high places and be able to see at a very high level and maybe put boxes on top of shelves very easily at a height, again, 8, 9, 10s are going to be very attractive to me. If I'm looking at people that can more easily get into more confined spaces, let's say, and be able to move around in confined spaces, 1, 2, 3s might be a better fit for me. So it's not about good or bad. It's about what fits what we're trying to hire to. Does that make sense? I'm hoping I'm seeing their heads are nodding around the table. I'm hoping. Because that's a really important principle here. Because a lot of times if people get a report back and they see a number, they start drawing conclusions of whether it's good or bad, and it's neither. It just is what it is. And now the question is what does that mean? What does that mean in relationship to the job that I have, the job that I'm doing? What does it mean in relationship to how I'm relating to other people? And so there's a lot of great information that comes out of this. So let's run through this and so I can share what these scales mean. And again, if anybody has a question, just feel free to interrupt me. So the first part of this is the thinking style. So it's all about whether a person can really cope with the mental demands that the position has. How does the information come at them, and how do they like to simulate information? So the very first scale, which is the learning index, is a composite or a combination of the scores on the next four scales. So it all kind of rolls up into this learning index. And this, again, is really important. We're not measuring IQ here. It's more about how a person takes in information. So if we had two people, and one's to the right and one's to the left, and they both have a gallon of intelligence, just to use that as the measuring stick. So they both have a gallon of intelligence. So they're both exactly as intelligent as the other, but the way they like to take in information is different. So the person on the right, their gallon of information or gallon of intelligence is in a bucket. So it's open in the top, and if we pour information into this person, they're happy with that. You can just pour this stuff in, maybe a little bit splashes over the side because they're taking it in so fast, and they have to go back and check on a few things later, but they can just take a lot of stuff in really quickly. The person on the left, they prefer to have the information more dripped in, you know, bit by bit by bit. They tend to be maybe more a bit of a hands-on learner, like to work with something, and then they really understand it. And once they've got something, it's locked in. They don't have stuff splash over the side, but they're going to probably take longer to get the concepts at the beginning. But both of them get it. So the question isn't about intelligence. It's more about what's the environment that they're going to have to learn in. Are they going to have to take stuff in really quickly, or are they going to have the luxury of a bit more time to absorb it and be able to work with it over time? So this is a big difference on where our comfort level is for people. And you know, I'm not going to get too in-depth on this, but just to think about this for a second, if you've got somebody who's an 8 or 9 and likes to learn very quickly and take in a lot of information, yet we're going to give them information at sort of a 4 or 5 level, this is where they could get bored. If that's the way their environment is all the time, they're going to be probably fairly bored. And if we have somebody that's on the left-hand side and we're delivering information to them at a 6-7 rate and they're, say, a 2-3, they're going to be overwhelmed. They're going to be constantly stressed out because stuff's coming on so fast they're not going to feel that they really are grasping things. So the more we know about people, the more we can also tailor how we bring information to them and how we help them learn in their position as well. So just a little sidebar there, but it's really important in the coaching information that you can pull out of this as well. So let's take a look at each of these scales. And again, you've got all this information with you on your quick reference guide. You can come back and check this at any point in time. So I'll just kind of run through them relatively quickly. So the first thing is verbal skills. So when you complete an assessment, you get asked some questions on vocabulary. And if you have a really strong vocabulary and you have very precise words that you tend to use to explain things, you're probably going to be to the far right. If you've got a less proficient vocabulary and you like people to just use the words that get to the point, you're probably more to the left. And I know one of the people at our team scores really far to the right on this verbal skill, and she'll say a word sometime, and I'll just be scratching my head going, what is that word? I've never heard that before. And I'll look it up, and it's the perfect word for the situation. It's just I didn't know it. But that's just sometimes the case. Is people to the far right, that one of the things they have to be concerned about is sometimes they appear to be talking over people's heads with their words. They don't mean to. It's just they've got a real strong vocabulary. So that's just a difference there. So the question is do you need to have that strong of vocabulary in the job that you're in? Some places you do, some places you don't. The next one is verbal reasoning. So this is more understanding what's going on. So listening in on a conversation and quickly getting the gist of what's going on. Some people, when they're talking, they'll use analogies or metaphors or stories to make their point. And people that are far to the right, they pick up on that and they like that kind of way of learning and explaining things. People to the left, again, would prefer to just give me the facts, get to the point, stop talking all around things, let's just go with the concrete stuff here, and then we can move on. So they're not looking for the big story to tell things, just get to the point kind of thing. Numerical ability, and again, I know a few of you in the room have probably completed the Profile XT. There's a bunch of math, and some people really don't like that, and some people find it quite enjoyable. The numerical ability is just to get a sense of whether or not you do like math. Are you able to calculate things quickly and easily and feel comfortable with math? People to the far right, they do. They like the math. They often do math in their head versus using calculators or computers. If you're far to the left, you're always reaching for that calculator. You want to double-check things. It doesn't come as easily to you. Again, this is a really good one to stress. Is that if your job does not require you to be very quick with math, or you're not doing a lot of stuff with math, then we really don't care whether you're a 2-3-4 or a 3-4-5 or whatever. We wouldn't set this up as expecting you to be an 8-9-10 if you're not dealing with math. But if you are, then yeah, maybe we're more like 6-7-8 or 7-8-9 is that range that we might be setting for you to fall within to be at a superior level in your position. Numeric reasoning, this is not about adding numbers up, but it's more about understanding where the numbers are going. So budget projections, a lot of the work, in a pulp mill, there's obviously an ongoing review of what's happening as far as inputs and outputs. So again, this is that ability to understand that if this comes in, this is what's going to go out. And some people grasp that really quickly, and others don't. So if you're far to the right, you quickly can take a look at some numbers and kind of figure out where some trends and projections are going. And if you're far to the left, that's just not your thing. You're more comfortable if something's written down than if it's in a graph form or it's in a chart form. That doesn't feel as comfortable to you to take in information that way. So again, those four, the verbal skill, verbal reasoning, numeric ability, numeric reasoning, those roll up into understanding what a person's overall learning index is. And it's just influenced based on how they do in each of those four areas. So that's the learning index. So that helps us understand whether or not a person is going to fit well into their role as far as how the information is going to come to them. Will it be coming at them too fast, too slow, or just right? And it's also, again, very helpful to know this about somebody who's coming onto your team, so you, from a coaching perspective, can understand where you might need to spend a little bit more time or where you can just turn a person loose. And also, if you've completed the Profile XT yourself, and I highly recommend this for anybody who is a manager or supervisor, and then they're hiring people onto their team and they're completing a Profile XT, it's very important that you know where your scales are. Because if you're a 7 or an 8, let's say, on verbal skill, and you've just brought somebody in your team that they're a good fit for their position, and they're a four or a five. Let's say they're a four, and let's say you're an eight on verbal skill. We all, just our natural way we do things is we go with what's natural to us. So if I don't know any different, and I'm this eight on verbal skill, and I've just brought somebody in who's a four on verbal skill, I'm just going to speak the way I'd normally speak. But if I know that they're not going to have as quite as strong a vocabulary as me, I may think a little bit differently about the words I choose. And let's say I've got somebody that I've just hired that their numerical reasoning is an eight, and I'm a four, and so I really don't like working with graphs and charts, but they're really good at it. My natural inclination might be to spend a lot of time with them explaining about charts and graphs and where they're going because that's what I require. Well, they would just have it figured out right away. So I could just hand it over to them and say, let me know if you have any questions, because they'll just get it. And it won't feel right necessarily to me because it's different than what I am, but it's the right thing to do for them. Otherwise, they're going to be bored. Why am I spending so much time telling them all about these graphs when they've already got them figured out? So it's really helpful for us to know about ourselves as well as the people that are on our teams, because we can coach them differently and we can adjust our approach to them to make it most comfortable for them. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. Okay, so the next piece we're looking at here is behavioral traits, and we look at 9 behavioral traits. So we'll just run through these. So energy level, if you're far to the right, you like things coming at you pretty fast. You always like to be busy. You tend to be a good starter, not necessarily the best finisher. And if you're far to the left, you tend to like to do things one at a time, get something done, lock it down, put a bow on it, move on to the next. You don't like a lot of things happening at the same time, but you're really good at getting things locked down and finished before you move on to the next thing. So you tend to be a lot more patient. So in any of these behavioral traits that we're looking at, it doesn't mean that a person can't be different in their role. So the person that's far to the left, if all of a sudden there's a shutdown or something and now they've got to do a lot more stuff in a short period of time, no problem. They can likely rise to the occasion, but for a small period of time. Then they have to get back to what their regular energy level is at. And this does not mean they're lazy because they're a 2, 3, 4. It just means they like to have things more at a regular pace. That's just their process. They can be just as efficient. They get things done, but they like things at a regular pace. So if we take people out of their comfort level for too long, it's going to wear them out and stress them out, and we're going to have problems. So for short periods of time, no problem. But for long periods of time, we will have problems. So the next thing is assertiveness. So far to the right, you tend to be very direct, take control. People that are far to the right often aren't very diplomatic. They lack a bit of tact because they just drive right to the point. They get to the heart of the matter, and they think everybody else operates the same way as that, and that's not always the case. Far to the left, not really so much of a need to prove that they're in charge. They may, in fact, be in charge of something, but they don't have a big deal about, you know, it's not an ego thing or anything like that. They tend to be more diplomatic, and they're fine with working with a team, too. And sometimes people look at this scale and they think that, well, you've got to be far to the right to be a good leader, and that's not necessarily the case. If you're in a situation where you need to have a team buy-in and part of what you're doing, if you're not very diplomatic and you always take charge and you always make all the decisions, then you may find that you don't have a team following you anymore. So it really depends on what's necessary in the role in the company, in the industry. There's so many factors that come into it on how you determine what that scale is for superior performance. Sociability, people far to the right, really good with the small talk. They like being around people. They're not the people that want to work by themselves. They definitely want to be around people all the time, like working in team settings, that type of thing. People far to the right much prefer to just sort of work on their own, be by themselves. They don't have a lot of need for a lot of social contact. We will see sometimes within industries that there is groupings, like one of the companies that we worked with is an accounting firm, and most of the accountants were kind of like 2, 3, 4, and that's perfect fit because they were generally working on their own. They were in their offices. They didn't need a lot of contact. They were working with paper, and they were happy to do that. That's what they like to do. But we did have a couple people on the team that were 7s and 8s, and these people just stood right out because they were really social, and they were the ones that would plan any get-togethers and this kind of thing, and they'd be out of their offices a lot more often than the other people. So we will find those types of groupings based on industry. But again, to the left, to the right, it doesn't matter. It's what fits with the position. Manageability, if you're far to the right, you tend to be the good soldier, which means if we ask you to do something, you just do it. You don't question why, you just go ahead and do it. If you're far to the left, you tend to question authority. You do ask, why are we doing it this way? What about, is there a better way to do it, this type of thing? So again, there's times when we'd want people to be like that person that challenges things and not just accept things as they are. And in some roles, we just want people just to do what they're told, so to speak. You know, just do what we ask you to do. We don't want questions on this, just please get this done. So again, it sort of depends what we need in that particular role is where we set the scale. Now, I mentioned this a few different times, so let me some of you may not know what I'm talking about here, but what happens is we work with companies and organizations that we're working with. For the positions within the company, we develop what we call performance models. And what a performance model is, like, so let's say on manageability, let's say we determine that we get our best performance or superior performance for people in a particular position if they score between a 5 and a 7 on manageability. And we figured this out through we have a few different processes for determining this, but what we would do then is we would set that scale on this performance model for this ABC position as a 5 to 7 range on manageability. Then when somebody completes the profile XT and we compare the results to the performance model, we'd find whether they fit as a 5, 6, 7 on manageability. If they were a 5, a 6, or a 7, we'd say, wow, great, they're a perfect fit for this performance model. If they were an 8 or a 4, we'd say, oh, they're just outside, one side or the other. And if they're a 1 on manageability and we're looking for a 5, 6, 7, we're saying, okay, that's not a really good fit. This is going to be a person that questions everything, and we're looking for a person that generally is going to go along with things, maybe questions things from time to time. So when I'm talking about these ranges, that's what I'm referring to, is what we would set up as a performance model that tells us what a top performer would look like in this position. Attitude, so if you're far to the right, it's your positive expectancy. You just believe things are going to work out. And if you're to the left, you tend to be more skeptical, and so you're taking a look at what maybe could go wrong in a situation. And there's a little example in this slide that, you know, a quality controller, safety officer, we probably want them to the left. We'd want them to be thinking about what the downside is on things and not just assume that everything works out, because that would be their job. So we, you know, getting somebody who's an 8 or a 9 as your security guard at a store, they're holding the door open for the thieves as they go out because they just trust everybody, right? And that wouldn't be a very good fit. So again, you could have people 1, 2, 3 or 8, 9, 10 on any of these scales, just depending on what you're hiring into. The next scale is decisiveness, and this is not whether you make good decisions, but again, how you make your decisions. So if you're far to the right, you're quite comfortable making a quick decision and accepting the risk that goes with that, and you don't need all the information. You can go ahead and make a decision. And if you're far to the left, you want a lot of information before you make your decisions, and you're not willing to accept a lot of risk. So I know one of our clients, it scored a 2 on decisiveness and talked to me and said, yeah, I don't know, I make really good decisions. I don't know, I got a 2 on this. And I said, well, what's your role? And they said, they're the controller of their organization, so financial controller, they're the head accountant. And I said, well, you know, this says as a 2 that you take your time in decisions, you take a lot of information, you don't accept risk. Sounds to me like that's what they'd want as a controller. He says, yeah, I guess that makes sense. And, you know, a few years ago when that pilot Sully landed the plane on the Hudson River, again, that's why we see pilots here far to the right. You know, he's got to make a quick decision, and he's got to accept that there's some risk with it, but he can't go back to the cabin and ask the passengers what they think he should do. He can't start consulting manuals. He's losing engines. He's got to make a decision right now. So, again, we got to decide what we need. Accommodating, if you're far to the right, you go along to get along. So you'll give in on your position fairly quickly for the harmony of the team. If you're far to the left, you're reluctant to give in your position, and you'll fight it. And sometimes that's really good, especially if you're the subject matter expert. You need to hang on to that, and sometimes that is at the disruption of the team. So, again, we have to think about what's going to be more important for the role that we're in. And again, being aware of this is really important. One of our clients, the president of the company, he's a one on accommodating, and he knows this, and he tells everybody this: I'm a one on accommodating. So if you're going to change my mind, you better come prepared. So that's actually kind of good heads up for anybody. Don't come in with this kind of a half-baked idea. Come in with something that's fully cooked, because you're going to have to sell it if it's not the way he's thinking. And he's just really upfront with it. So it's kind of good that way, is that they're very open with discussing where they score on these different scales. So it helps them understand how they might approach different things with different people. And I think that's pretty healthy, and it's a good place to be. We have many of our clients that are just like that. They really understand the scales, and they talk about that. They'll say, oh, you're too unaccommodating is coming out today. Come on, just listen to my side here, something like that. So they have a little fun with it. So independence is the next one, and if you're far to the right, you like to just run with things, you like to get a bit of information, then just go. You don't like to be micromanaged at all. You don't like a lot of oversight. You just want your independence. If you're far to the left, you're looking for a lot of feedback, and you're not going to take a lot of chances, and you're not going to run too far on your own. You like to know how you're doing. So this, I use this as an example of, again, if I'm the leader and I've just hired somebody and I'm an 8 on independence, again, my natural inclination is to think that everybody is the same as me and is fairly independent. But if I've just hired somebody, good fit for the position, but they're a 3 on independence, they want feedback. So if I just turn them loose, because that's what I'd like, they're going to feel like they're lost. They're going to feel like I've abandoned them. So I have to adjust my approach and spend more time and check with them for feedback. And vice versa, if I'm a 3 on independence and I've just hired somebody who's an 8, again, good fit for the position I've hired them to, but if I'm checking with them every few minutes, they're going to think they've really made a big mistake because they're feeling like they're being micromanaged. So I have to adjust my approach with those people. The last of the behavioral traits is objective judgment. And so people far to the right tend to be pragmatic, and they like to crunch the numbers as they're going through things and really look at things from a practical perspective. And people on the left, they go more with their instinct and go with their gut, and they're more subjective in their approach on how they look at things. So one way of looking at it is that people far to the right go with their head, and people to the left go with their gut and have a gut feel on things, and they'll just approach things that way. And again, you know, that's actually really powerful in a team setting where you're taking a look at something that you might be going ahead with, some project or some idea or some change. And if you've got some people that are pragmatic thinkers and subjective thinkers in the room, that's really healthy, because they'll look at things from different perspectives, and that's pretty strong. And that accounting firm I was mentioning before, interestingly enough, all the partners in that accounting firm score like a 2, 3, 4 on objective judgment, and you'd think accountants would be over on the pragmatic, practical side of the fence there on the far to the right. But the partnership group, they made a lot of their decisions by really seeing what they thought was happening out there in industry and what changes they had to make for the overall business, and it worked for them. They made really good decisions that were more intuitive rather than crunching necessarily all the numbers. So that's our behavioral traits. And the last thing we're left with is our occupational interests. And in the reporting that comes out on the Profile XT, you can actually see scales on everything we've talked up to this point in time. We don't actually show the scales on the occupational interests. You just find out whether a person's top 3 interests are aligned with what the top 3 interests are in the position. So the 6 different interests we look at is first enterprising. If you're far to the right, you like sharing ideas and concepts and often like sales activities and this type of thing. If you're far to the left, that's just not a big interest to you. So either something that you're fired up about or you're not. Financial administrative, if you're really, really interested in this area, you'd be farther to the right, and you like organizing things. You like making sure things are in the right file. You like filling out the forms. Everything has a place and every place has a thing. You're that person, and you like financial administrative type of work. If you're far to the left, that's not of interest to you, and keeping things organized is not your top priority. People service, this is actually not whether you like people or not. That's more the sociability, but this is more like you can draw a pretty direct line that the work you do is helping people. So, you know, if you're a social worker or you're a teacher, or say when you're working in a hospital, you're probably able to draw a pretty close connection to the work that you do is helping people, and in lots of other work, it's not as important that you see a direct impact or a direct benefit for people. So if you're far to the right, you need to see that. That's a big interest for yours, for yourself. Technical, again, just as you'd kind of expect, it's activities, both scientific, technical activities. So the people that are working in the labs, people that are coming up with new approaches to things and inventing things and this type of thing, they're going to be more technical in nature. And if you're not that technical person, you're not going to score real high on this. And you just like the fact that when you flip the switch on, the lights go on and you really don't care how it works. It's just good that it works, sort of thing. Mechanical, people that score high on this, they like working with their hands, they like working outside, they like working with machinery. It's a strong interest for them, and they're motivated to do their work when they get that opportunity to work in that environment. And last is creative, and there's no doubt about it, the people that work in a creative environment, like the arts, whether it's dancing or singing or anything like that, they will score high on this. But it's also people that are creative thinkers will also score quite high on this, and they like to, build things or create different things or look at new ways of doing things. They'll also often score quite high on this. So those are the six interests. And so what happens is when a person completes Profile XT, they will score on each of these different scales a particular scoring based on how they've answered it. And then what that does is it just gives information that can then be used to compare a person to a performance model to find out what kind of a fit they might be within a particular job or position. There's about 9 or 10 different reports we can generate to help if we're hiring somebody for interview guides. There's sort of coaching reports. We call them performance model comparison reports, but it gives you coaching information. And there's all kinds of great stuff that can come out of this process. That's pretty much the presentation. There's other things. There's a lot of other things that we can share about the Profile XT and other assessment tools we use. But that's kind of the overview for today as far as understanding the background behind why the Profile XT has been created and what the different scales. And I'll look at that with this quick reference guide and this understanding, and it may be helpful for you. It might make more sense on this, understanding that it's a sort of a continuum, if you will, and it doesn't really matter, again, whether a person scores a 3, a 7, a 10, a 1. It's just who you are. And then it's really about how does that work in the environment that you're fitting in. And we don't get people that are 100% fits for positions. That doesn't happen very often. But you do look for a fairly close fit, something in that, 75, 80, 85% fit, because then that says that there's maybe a few areas in the position that you're not going to feel 100% comfortable with, and that's life. We have to deal with some of that stuff, and there's things we can learn for workarounds. But it gives us a heads up much sooner about how close a fit a person is and where we might need to spend a little extra time coaching just to really have them excel in their position.